Hello, everyone. I am Joshua Gilliland. With me is Jessica Meterson. We are the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks, and we are to discuss the 1980 classic Airplane from a time when people could travel. And I miss those days. But we'll talk more about what it was like to fly in the 1980s when we were kids and all the legal lessons from this classic, amazing film. Jessica, how are you? At the end of 2020.
Well, I'm very excited that it's almost the end of 2020. I think that's about all I can say at the moment. Just counting down at this point, literally counting down the minutes until the end of 2020. And I thought you were going to say talking about Airplane in 1980 from a time when people could be completely offensive and inappropriate and get away with it. And mind you, I say this as someone who is a big defender of political correctness and respecting people and just trying to be considerate and respectful to others. But still, you watch Airplane and I do love it, but you're like, oh my God, I can't believe they're saying and doing these things in a movie.
Yeah, when people realized, hey, that's a joke, it's okay. Like it's not, yeah. But we'll talk about some of that when it comes to the First Amendment in the airport, but more on that in a moment. So there's a lot to unpack from this film. And again, it could be a wonderful law school exam with all the different issues that are in it. But like in any airplane flight, it begins at the airport. And as people enter the airport, there was something that you don't see nowadays. Because again, not just because it's the pandemic and we're not getting on airplanes anymore, but you see people saying like, hi, you know, Hare Krishna, and wanting to give somebody a flower or a juice for Jesus. And, you know, the pamphleteers at the airport, that doesn't happen anymore. And that's because there was a bunch of lawsuits because those folks really annoyed the wrong people, including one one U.S. Supreme Court Justice, Anthony Kennedy, who clearly did not like those guys, and he was a huge First Amendment hawk. So what are you familiar with the case history?
I'm not. I do have a specific story with a Hare Krishna that I'll have to tell. But first, I do want to hear this story because, yeah, I guess, you know, I think I don't recall too many pamphleteers at airports outside of the movie Airplane, of course. So no. So when was this decision and who had standing to bring this, right? Because, of course, one of the parts of a lawsuit is you don't get to bring a lawsuit unless you can show you have some personal connection to the injury or the issue being contested. So not just any random person can file a lawsuit on any random thing. Many of you may be aware of standing because that came up with a lot of the election lawsuits and, you know, who actually has a right to bring a lawsuit about different election issues. But so, yeah, so when was this decided? And I really want to know who brought this case, who had the standing to bring this case.
So this case was from 1992, and it was Rehnquist delivered the opinion of the court, but Kennedy was, being the good swinger that he was, helped with it as well. And basically, people got fed up with pamphleteers at the airport. So an airport enacted an ordinance saying, like, you can't do that anymore. So the people affected who were not allowed in to bring their pamphlets.
So it's the people who are wanting to distribute the pamphlets that sued because, okay. All right. Okay.
So what the case turned on was the determination that an airport terminal operated by a public authority is a non-public forum, and thus a ban on solicitation needed only to satisfy a reasonableness standard. And it did. So like, that's the punchline here of, it's not a traditional public forum. And when you think about it now, it's truly not a traditional public forum because...
Yeah, this is pre all the security stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's funny when you watch the different airport disaster movies from the 70s, you know, the first one begins with no inspections of the luggage. So like, that's how the bad guy brings the bomb onto the airplane. And in like, that's a plot point with one of the TSA agents, but they weren't TSA agents then.
Right. Like,
oh, that guy was suspicious. I wish I could, you know, search his bag. Well, that type of story wouldn't happen anymore because of the world we live in. So when we see the airport security in Airplane, 1980, they make fun of going through the metal detector, and the, you know, and one of the passengers has a, you know, and like a metal arm and a metal foot. Mm-hmm. And again, so like they're having fun with that. But in the old days, you know, like you could accompany someone, you know, who was like visited and you were just dropping them off at the airport and they didn't have to wait alone. You could like go with them to the gate and hang out with them there. Now you don't get to do that unless you're picking up a kid or like a family member who needs assistance traveling. Like there's really a few circumstances where you could do that. But in the old days, you could.
And that's I have to give her a shout out. My favorite, my AP US history teacher, Miss Agrenowich. She talked about she would go to the airport and sit at the restaurant there because she liked to watch the planes take off. And so, yeah, so it truly was, that's true, more of a public space where people could come and go just to visit, just to hang out at the restaurant, like you said, to see people. Now, yeah, if you're not intending to fly, pretty much the only people in the airport are either working there or the people who are intending to fly.
Yeah, and they all go through security.
Right.
So it's truly not a public forum in this day and age because you're subject to search. There's a whole laundry list of reasons why. But the way that the Supreme Court opinion went, yeah, this was a reasonable standard to have because you were just annoying the hell out of everyone. That's the that's the punchline. They don't outright say that, but you can tell that somebody annoyed Justice Kennedy at the wrong point while traveling, which is how we end up with this decision. So
nice.
We have lots of other public forums, but the airport's not one, which isn't why you don't see what you saw in this movie with that parody, because it was like that in the 70s and early 80s, and that could get a little obnoxious kind of fast. So
it can, but here's where my story comes into play. It definitely was post that. I'm trying to remember when it was. I was traveling, I was in Los Angeles for work, so, and I was flying out of LAX, and I can't remember if that was my career, my brief PR career before law school, or if it was as a young lawyer. But I was approached by a young man. I do not know if he was a Hare Krishna because my knowledge of that religion is very limited. I do believe, though, just based on my movie exposure, that it appeared to be something like a Hare Krishna kind of religion. But he talked to me for a few minutes, and I, to this day, remember, I have never met anyone who radiated such peace and joy as that man. He did not hand me anything. I did not join any groups or anything. I did have to leave to get to my gate. But to this day, I think fondly of that person, and just that I've never seen so much peace and joy in one person as that person. So maybe I should check out the Hare Krishna faith because I could use some peace and joy right now.
Most of America could.
Yes. So see, maybe we need the pamphlets back.
There are plenty of other public forums where they could be handing those out. Courthouse sidewalk, park. There's lots of places where they can gather and do that. They just not at the airport.
No.
So now we do then get into the issue of, this is a common carrier. And back in the olden days,
the airlines.
Back in the olden days, there was this thing called smoking on airplanes. Mm-hmm. That's, again, astounding for people born in the 21st century that happened. And
I flew on some of those planes.
Yeah, I don't remember when it stopped, but I think it was mid 80s.
Well, I think it was a little bit later because I was flying. The time when I would have been flying would have been late 80s. And that's when I definitely know there was still smoking on the planes. And in fact, I'm now looking up, I believe, so I went to, my undergrad was at GW, George Washington University. I did not go to law school there, but one of the law school professors did class actions. And I believe they did a class action lawsuit on the smoking on planes. And that was, let's see. Yeah, I think he was actually, John Bonjoff is his name. And he was actually the one, I think he was very big. He used the public lawsuits to try to stop the smoking. And I think he had some role in that, in stopping the smoking on airplanes. Because I can tell you, I did it and it was miserable. I mean, I had to fly in a plane where they were smoking, and it was not fun.
Yeah, I remember being a kid. Then there was also the long period when we weren't traveling because that's the way life was. And here we are. So there are no more smoking sections. There are rare meal service on airplanes. There are very limited number of airlines that still serve meals. Hawaiian did the time I flew back from Kauai.
Was that your Sea Scout thing that you got to do there?
Yeah. And so I was like, wow, there's meal service?
Nice.
Yeah. And I think Alaska has occasionally. I don't remember. But again, just very few airlines still do it. And as opposed to the flight attendant coming down the aisle with the snack box that's $7 or whatever.
Yeah.
And so again, this was the days when there was meal service. So again, that does not exist anymore.
No.
For a whole bunch of reasons that we're not going to get into, because that's a different history with the rise and fall, near collapse and rebirth of the airline industry. Or companies like TWA or Pan America, things that don't exist.
No, but another connection between lawyers and airlines. One of my previous clients when I was down in Texas was Southwest Airlines, which of course is sort of well known for being low cost, but also a ton of fun. And while it was not actually started by Herb Kelleher, he is a lawyer who took over Southwest from, I think, its original founders when it was basically a tiny little thing in Dallas and turned it into the massive operation that it is now known for. So, lots of lawyer connections here just to the industry in general.
And Southwest, what an inspiring story.
Yeah.
Like the folks at JetBlue, another inspiring story.
Yes.
But that's not important right now. What is what is a common carrier? And we should talk about that, because when you get into an airplane or a bus or a boat
or a
carriage, I have a feeling we're going to be talking a lot about trains the next 4 years. And again, I'm okay with a sudden love of Amtrak. but a common carrier is everyone who offers to the public to carry persons, property, or messages, accepting only telegraphic messages, is a common carrier of whatever he thus offers to carry. And airlines are common carriers because you just hopped in an airplane. It's expected to fly safely. They don't give you parachutes. Like they expect you to get to the destination, and you're entrusting them with your care, which is why we have all these regulations in place. And it's there because it's a wonderful, again, I love airplanes. My family is heavily connected to the airline industry and aerospace. So again, just things that I do love. I do enjoy a meal at an airport restaurant, and there are a lot of public ones where you can be on the flight line and enjoy a burger and watch airplanes take off. But if you are flying on an airline, they have the utmost duty of care to you. They're serving meals. That raises a new question, because they've either prepared the meal or they contracted for the meal. And it raises the question, is the meal part of being a common carrier, or is it something else entirely? And Jess, putting on your litigator cap, what do you think it falls under?
The actual service of food on the common carrier?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that that's part of the common carrier thing. I mean, the whole point, and I think that's what we need to explain, the reason why it's important if you're a common carrier versus like some sort of private carrier, is that basically if you're a common carrier, you basically cannot refuse to take people. So you can't say we're not going to take you because, you know, of the color of your skin or your religion or your age or your gender or something like that, right? So, I mean, that's the the key distinction with common carriers. Basically, if there's enough space and you can pay whatever the fee is that they're charging, a common carrier has to transport you. And that's, and again, you know, if it's a common carrier within a state, the states would regulate it. In the case of airplane, they were flying, was it they're flying from Chicago to LA, right? I think that's the way they were going.
Reverse. So LA.
Oh, is it LA to Chicago? I always get that backwards. So because there it's interstate, then it's actually the Commerce Clause of the Constitution that allows the federal government then to regulate you. So most airlines, unless they only operate within a state, are going to be governed by federal law. So I just say all that to explain why the significance of a common carrier. But again, I do not practice in this area, but the food, I would think that you would still, again, I don't think you should be able to refuse it to serve to anyone. And I guess you would still, I mean, I guess what you're saying is, do you have just a net usual, you can't be negligent in providing the food, or do you have a higher duty to provide extra safe food? Is that what the question is?
That's what the question is, because a common carrier, you have the utmost duty.
Right.
Because they, you, the passengers have entrusted their safety to you. So is it the food prep that falls under that, or is this something else? Because there's no other restaurant at, you know, 37,000 feet.
True, but I would argue that the food is not a necessary element of getting you to your destination, and you do not need to eat the meal. Unless, of course, unless it is at some point absurdly long and they refuse to allow you to bring any food on. So I would say, since it's not a necessary component, that should not be held to the higher standard of care for common carriers. Am I right?
I don't know. That's why we're discussing it. And I agree with you. Because I don't see it as part of the flight.
In right.
Since
not a necessary part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one thing if like they lose cabin pressure, that sort of thing. Like then we're into that higher standard of care.
Yes.
Meal service, I think that's a tougher question. And maybe if we really dug into legal research, maybe there are cases that dealt with this in the 70s or again, let's just say that they actually were preparing food like that. I think that would then trigger it. Like somebody gets burned with hot oil if they're doing banana flambe in the aisle, like something weird
right.
like that.
Yeah.
Which would have been hyper exclusive in the 50s only, would have been the only time that happened. And it happened twice and people realized it was a bad idea. So like that sort of, whoa, let's not do that ever again, because it's not smart at 37,000 feet. Yeah, good times. So,
speaking of common carriers and duties of care, one of the things that stuck out to me in airplane is a topic that my son has been grilling me on a lot lately, that he's kind of a teenager obsessed with this idea, which is that kind of that duty is, speaking of the duty of care, obviously, you know, once the pilot and co-pilot and I guess navigator were sick and they needed somebody to fly the plane, of course, Ted reluctantly stepped up and agreed to fly the plane. But this ties into the issue my son just has a hard time wrapping his head around, which is this idea that, you know, Ted did not need to step up and actually fly the plane. Ted could have said, even though I'm a pilot and in theory qualified to fly this plane, mental health issues notwithstanding, I'm going to say no, and I'm going to let us all crash because I don't feel like doing this. And this idea, this American, and I think it's actually British as well, this idea that there is no general duty of care that we owe to each other, that I do not owe a duty to try to rescue a stranger. And that's, again, that's why Ted, because there is no general duty of care, Ted did not owe that duty. He did not have to save a plane full of people if he didn't feel like it. If he's like, you know what, I'm willing to go down and I'm going to bring everyone down with us. And legally, he's entitled to do that. That concept is one that my son has been having a really hard time with. And I do think it's a weird idea because, of course, we all want to help our neighbors, help people out. But this idea that legally we are not required to help out strangers is a tough one to wrap people's heads around. So that was one of the issues I was thinking about during that. And of course, once Ted did step in, most states, and of course, this also if you're a Seinfeld fan, which also ties in Lloyd Bridges and the Mandelbaums, but of course, most states have a Good Samaritan law that say, okay, you don't need to step up and help people. Of course, in the Seinfeld finale, they were in a state, I think there were a few states that briefly did actually require you to take reasonable steps to help other people. And that was why, of course, Seinfeld and the crew didn't do that. And so they were charged, I think that was in Massachusetts, they were charged them with a crime for not doing that. But in general, there is no duty to help strangers. But if you do start to help strangers, and let me pull up, like California has, usually what they call it is a Good Samaritan law. And the idea is that they want to encourage people to help strangers without worrying that they're going to get sued if their help doesn't do anything, or if their help doesn't actually end up helping the situation, or maybe even makes things worse. So in general, like the California Health and Safety Code provides that no person who in good faith and not for compensation renders emergency medical or non-medical care at the scene of an emergency shall be liable for any civil damages resulting from any act or omission. So assuming California law applied to this, and there's always choice of law issues when you've got a plane leaving, well, and then you've got federal laws, I guess. You've got a plane leaving California, landing in Chicago. No, leaving Chicago, landing in California. But assuming the California law would apply, what this means is that if Ted, operating in good faith and not getting paid, agreed to fly the plane, and that's the emergency non-medical situation, and that's the care he's providing. If, for example, when he was landing the plane, either luggage got damaged or somebody got bounced around and got hurt, they could not sue him and say, hey, the way you flew this plane and landed this plane made me get hurt and I needed stitches or I broke my arm or something. They say, no, you can't sue Ted for those things because, as the California legislature explicitly said, it's the intent of the legislature to encourage other individuals to volunteer without compensation to assist others in needs of an emergency while ensuring that those volunteers who provide care or assistance act responsibly. So basically, the only time that they do say, but you know what, if you offer to help someone and then you act in a way that's actually like gross negligence or willful or wanton misconduct in that so-called help, and I'm now putting air quotes around it, then you could be held liable. But that's one of the things I've been thinking, that I always think about when watching Ted step up there to fly the plane.
You also get the issue of abandoning a rescue.
That's right.
So you don't have a duty to rescue.
Yes.
Even if you're the only one who, he's still out of his league, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But so you're a good Samaritan and you try landing the plane and the front wheel breaks and you bounce everyone around in their crash positions, like that's, you should be protected under that circumstance. Cause the other option was everyone dies and we want to encourage somebody with flight experience to step up and
right,
land the plane.
And not be afraid that they won't be able to do it perfectly. Right.
On the flip side, if you abandon a rescue, so yes, the example of, you see the drowning person or person in distress in the water. So you swim out, you start towing them in, and then you go like, oh, I'm tired. And you let them go and swim back in and they drown. You abandon a rescue. Now this is not the situation where they're trying to drown you, which is frequently happens with a drowning victim. They try to drown the person that's trying to save them because of panic.
Right.
So this is,
Don't have to risk your own life for it.
Yeah, you just let them go.
Right, but if it's an unreasonable abandonment like that, you can be held liable, right? That's what you're saying? Yes, yeah. Agree. Once you take on the effort to try to do something, again, like if you're trying to rescue someone from a burning car, if you abandon it, the attempted rescue, because a car bursts into even greater flames, that is reasonable and understandable. But yes, if you halfway through decide, you know what, actually, I really did want to get to that dinner after all, so I'm just going to leave you now kind of thing, then yes, then you can be held liable. Yeah, once you've taken on the beginning of a duty, then you have basically said, this is now a duty I'm taking on, and then those rules apply. But otherwise, yeah, this idea, I think a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their head around that idea that in general, there isn't a duty to respond. But since I mentioned him, I do now have to bring up, I mean, there's so many characters in airplane that I love, but Lloyd Bridges has always just had a special place in my heart. And I don't know if it's from Airplane or he was also, and looking at his IMDb page, he was in the George Washington miniseries that like made a serious impression on me back in the early 80s. Like Barry Bostwick playing George Washington, to this day, I think of that. And of course, Josh and his brother have a connection to Barry Bostwick. But I love Lloyd Bridges. And so of course, you know, Izzy Mandelbaum then too on Seinfeld, which is so freaking amazing. But tying in the other lawyer connections, I was just reading his IMDb page and I saw that Lloyd Bridges, as a young man, his parents actually wanted him to be a lawyer. And he was smart and went to UCLA and pursued acting instead. And so now I'm super jealous.
So Lloyd Bridges is a comedic legend, and the deadpan humor, all the one-liners with looks like I quit, picked the wrong week to quit drinking. And just to sniffing glue, like,
yes, I picked the wrong week to stop sniffing glue. Those lines are so awesome. And I say them all the time and people stare at me like I'm crazy. And I'm like, how do you not know what I'm referencing? Like, I'm now judging you. You're judging me because I mentioned that I sniffed glue before. I'm now judging you because you don't know what that reference is.
That and Robert Stack.
Yes.
Whether it's
Captain Unsolved Rex.
Whether it's Unsolved Mysteries or The Untouchables, his deadpan humor, and again, beating the snot out of all the pamphleteers at the airport, doing the fighting moves from his Untouchable days, was just awesome. So, Rex Kramer, as opposed to Rex Tillerson, different Rex.
Very different Rex,
but not a lot of men are named Rex, so that's
true. Huh.
It's a thing. So that said, wonderful issues there. Now let's get into the issue of airline culpability. So let's focus on the meal prep. If it's not held to the high degree of being a common carrier, and it's just negligence standard, is it negligence or is this product liability? What category would the meal prep fall under? Because they were pre-made meals, like little TV dinners, and you had the steak or the chicken, except for the doctor who had the lasagna somehow. And again, Leslie Nielsen. But let's get into that wonderful issue of what do you think, how would we evaluate the meal prep? Is it negligence or is it product defect?
Well, I think there's a couple things there. I mean, first of all, one thing, and I'd be curious to see this too, talking about how things have changed over the years, you know, the evolutions of what passengers have agreed to when they purchase a ticket has changed. I mean, I forget exactly the case, but one case we learned about in law school was about one of the cruise lines that basically, you know, once you signed up for a cruise, and of course they have all kinds of illness things. Oh, it looks like Josh, do you know what case I'm talking about?
Carnival Cruise with the forms selection clause.
Exactly. Where you're only allowed to sue in, like, I don't know if it was Florida or where it was, but you're only allowed to sue in one place. Basically, what they're doing is when you sign up, and we all do it, I even do it as a lawyer, because I'm like, yeah, I can't argue with them. It really limits, it's often an arbitration. It limits your abilities to where you can sue, what you can sue for, how you can sue. Now, I would be curious to know when those changes came about, right? In 1980, were passengers basically forced to give up so many of their legal rights when purchasing an airplane ticket as opposed to now? I'm sure that's been an evolution. I don't know where it was in 1980. So that'd be the first question that I would have to look at is what rights have we already signed away? Have we basically already said, you know, we're not going to sue them for anything? I mean, that being said, to me, I'm suing, assuming I haven't given away my rights. If I'm a passenger who has fallen ill because of this, the meal they serve me, I'm suing the airline. I'm saying, you had an obligation to serve a decent meal, a safe meal, not even decent meal, a safe meal. You were negligent in doing that. I'm suing you. Now, could the airline turn around and bring in the company that they subcontracted with to provide those meals and sue them for contribution or indemnification? I mean, I can tell you, you know, I do a lot of construction cases, and in some ways it's the same thing as an owner who says, hey, I wanted a bridge that was built this way. It's a cruddy bridge, so I'm suing you, general contractor. And the general then sues all the subcontractors. And then you've got, you know, 5 years of litigation where everyone's pointing fingers at each other. Because what the food safety companies say, it's not our fault. You let them sit on a hot tarmac for, you know, 2 days before loading them onto a plane. And so, of course, they went bad when they were sitting there. You didn't properly refrigerate or store, or they were expired. Those were actually meals that, you know, had gone bad. So there's two parts. There's both that food safety part, and then there's also the risk caused by the fact that the airline allowed the pilot, the co-pilot, and the navigator to all eat the same meals. I would sue for that too, saying, hey, that's really negligent. You know that, you know, with these kind of little TV meals that there could be a potential food issue there. So I would sue for that too.
Yeah, on the behind the scenes, they actually talk about that because that was a rule that the flight crew would not eat the same food.
Okay. There and was so, actually a rule that they violated for the movie.
Yeah. So when the consultant brought that up, the reply was like, well, if we follow that, we don't have a film. So we're just going to ignore that part.
And movies aren't very good at doing that. If they actually followed all the rules and all the good decision-making processes, you wouldn't have any plot.
Wow, that was a close call. Glad we all didn't eat that. Like, that would be... and, yeah.
Victor could check his vectors since he hadn't had the fish.
Yeah, yeah, it's... Yes. So, agreed. Yeah, that raises... The lawsuit would actually be quite fascinating because did the airline just buy the meals from some third-party contractor? Did they prepare them themselves? Because that might have been a thing. They might have done that. Was it then not stored correctly? Because it's fish, and it's the fish that nearly kills everybody.
Ugh.
So it's like, yeah, what? And it's all the fish. Mm-hmm. So does that mean, was it the sauce? Was it how it's prepared? Because I understand one fish getting somebody sick.
Right.
But when it's the entire catch, that tends to point to how it was prepared. And we're now granted right now, that's more of a res ipsa loquitur type argument because we don't have expert witnesses dissecting the fish to backtrack how it was made. We don't have the meal, since all meal service was then halted on the other airlines, we don't know like what kind of testing took place to figure out like, whoa, that was a bad sauce, or this entire batch was undercooked or whatever.
Or if the airline had been cited before for not properly storing and preserving their food before they served it to customers?
Yeah.
Buyers? Passengers.
Which, again, so I think even if this was under a common carrier situation, they're totally screwed. If it's under a negligence factor, I think they also are on the hook. But the issue I go back to is who else gets sued?
Right.
And we don't have enough facts on the film, but we know the airline's definitely defendant number one. And whether or not anyone else gets pulled in either directly or as a cross on a cross complaint would be what to watch for.
Yep.
And in Airplane 2 with the courtroom flashbacks, we don't get into that, you know, but we do have, after many scout events and other activities, you know, one of the phrases that I have used was, bro was on, didn't trip, because that just sums up, you did a good job. So, yeah. So we also get the airline of, you know, at O'Hare, Lloyd Bridges and
Captain Rex.
Captain Rex discussing, hey, what do we do here? And maybe it's better that they just crash in the river so they don't kill more people, or the lake, because by the Great Lakes, and like the radio's clicked, so like all of that's transmitted.
Right.
Let's talk about the problem of if the airline decides the best course of action is for the plane to crash. And I don't see that ending good. I don't see that having a happy ending if the airline decides the best thing to do is to ditch the plane in the lake in the hopes that it won't take out a building or anyone.
Well, it's tough because usually when you have to judge that sort of thing, right? I mean, in a lot of lawsuits, especially tort involved things, when they talk about, you know, what's reasonable or was something negligent, is you do a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking. And usually under the law, there's two standards that or two kind of questions you can look at. And sometimes it's a combination, but sometimes they look at the subjective thing, you know, was the person in that situation at the moment, did they think that what they were doing was reasonable? And sometimes that's applied. Usually when it comes to tort law and whether something was negligent or grossly negligent or wanton misconduct, is would an objective person in that same situation think that that was a reasonable decision or a reasonable outcome? And again, that's the sort of thing, you know, where I could see this actually, if that were the question, if they had instead said, Ted, you know, crash landed in the lake instead, that's the safest outcome for the greatest number of people. I could then see litigation over that where, yes, the airline, they're actually, I think, not working for the airline. They're actually working, I guess, well, I guess Captain Rex is working for the airline. I'm not sure Lloyd Bridges' character, it was never clear if he's actually working like with air traffic control or the airport management. So I'm not quite sure who he would be as far as being able to sue him, but whether you could actually, basically you'd have to get expert testimony from other air traffic control people, other pilots, and say, you know, is this reasonable? If you were in this situation, what would be the possible options you would look at, and are those reasonable options?
Yeah, this, the most comparable things would be like a rocket launch. And the mission controllers practiced, hey, we've lost control of the vehicle. I have to detonate it so it will not crash into a neighborhood.
Right.
And I know I'm killing a U.S. astronaut in order to not destroy two city blocks. Like, they practiced that. And yeah, that would suck. Or, again, 9/11, when...
Yeah.
You know, when the decision was made, if an airline is not responding to us, you can shoot down the plane.
Right.
That had to suck. Like that, I mean, for all parties involved, mm-hmm. from the president giving the order to the pilots in the air, like, I don't want to shoot down a U.S. airliner.
Wow.
And but like, that was a horrific call that had to be made for public safety. This goes to the issue of like self-driving cars that make a decision of, do you save the driver or do you, if it means like hitting a bunch of people, or do you sacrifice the driver in order to save people on the sidewalk if given that situation?
Well, it's actually the old philosophical question, the trolley problem. I mean, which is actually brought up. And of course, for any fans of The Good Place, they discuss the trolley problem at length. So my kids, thanks to The Good Place, now know something about philosophy. But right, that's always a question. Do you risk this one person versus, you know, do you look at sheer numbers? Do you look at, you know, well, these people will definitely die either way versus these people may or may not. But your point about 9/11 actually applies here too, because one other thing, while common carriers, the airlines, and therefore presumably Captain Rex, are all working for private companies. So, but if Lloyd Bridges is working for air traffic, well, for the airport, I guess I'm not quite sure how airports are structured, but if he is working for anything that is some sort of governmental entity, so if he has any sort of connection to the government, like the pilots would have, or like the president or VP, like that you talked about, then any decisions he makes is actually given an extra level of protection that has come up a lot this past year in the role. It comes up a lot with police. And there's actually been attempts to overturn at the Supreme Court, which has not worked yet. But it's the idea of qualified immunity. And that's a legal principle that grants government officials performing discretionary functions, like Lloyd Bridges trying to decide what to do with this plane. It gives them immunity from civil suits unless a plaintiff can show that the government official violated clearly established statutory or constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known. And we could do a whole podcast on qualified immunity and the many problems with it and the many gross abuses that police officers in particular have been able to get away with under that doctrine. And even George Will, noted conservative, is like, and the Cato Institute, also conservative, are like, we've got to get rid of this doctrine. But for right now, it applies. So if Lloyd Bridges is actually working in a quasi-governmental function there at the airport, then any decision he makes, basically, unless it's just completely insane, he'd be protected. You basically wouldn't even be able to sue him. If you tried to sue him for his decision and what to do with the plane, he'd be able to shut it down basically at the motion to dismiss stage under the qualified immunity doctrine.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley. Which we didn't even talk about him. He, again, medical doctors. We didn't even talk about that. I don't know if you're going to discuss the great Leslie Nielsen.
God, I love that man so much. He, again, this was the A-team of comedic timing of people who were the classic straight man and able to deliver the straight line from Robert Stack to Leslie Nielsen to Lloyd Bridges, all perfect.
Yeah.
So the doctor, did he have a duty to act? And I was on an airline flight post 9/11 that had somebody have a medical emergency. And it was a woman at the back of the plane with her adult woman, with her mother, and the female passenger started having a seizure. And the mother started yelling code red, which this is 2004 and everyone turns bone knuckle right white because what the hell does that mean? It turns out she meant to yell code blue, which would be problem breathing, but instead she yelled code red. Mm-hmm. Scared the hell out of everyone. And I found out because the nurse was sitting in the window seat and I was in the aisle seat, and she used me as a springboard in her combat boots, which was super uncomfortable for a number of reasons. She did explain afterwards that medical professionals are like totally like not thrilled with the level of paperwork that they have to deal with that sort of situation. But it was her, and there was a doctor on the plane who went back and tended to the person, and she was okay. But that was my experience of learning there's a ton of paperwork and a bunch of them are not thrilled with the amount of hoops that they then have to jump through if they step up.
On the flip side,
my mom was a paramedic, and there were doctors, ER doctors at that time, who are kind of adrenaline junkies, you know, which might fit with a type A litigator personality.
Yeah.
And they would have basically like crash kits in their car in case they saw an accident. Like, so
they were ready to go.
They were ready to go. And like one doctor that she knew ended up like performing an amputation of a leg in the field type of thing. So you get the other extreme, the doctors who are like, booyah, let's do this. So,
well, and apparently most of the time doctors do have the same Good Samaritan protections, mm-hmm. where in most situations, if they're not there, like in a role already as a doctor, so like if they're just a passenger on a plane, they do not have an obligation to step up and help. But if they do, they have the same sort of Good Samaritan protections that you would have otherwise. Although apparently in Louisiana, Minnesota, and Vermont, there is a failure to act law. So in those states, if a physician is known to have walked away from a situation in which an individual requires emergency medical treatment, then they could be in violation of the law. I also found when I was looking for this, an article about like the Royal Academy of Medicine in Great Britain was trying to deal with exactly this situation of what should physicians do on airplanes. Because, you know, while most of the time the crew does have like basic, like sort of first aid, first responder kind of training, there are situations where you're up in the sky with no quick access to medical care and there's a patient with a dire emergency situation. And what should doctors do and what should they be expected to do in those situations? Nobody ever has emergency legal questions up on. I keep waiting for that, for somebody to say, I need a lawyer right now. Nobody's ever yelled that out on an airplane.
Yeah, I hope not. I really hope that doesn't happen. And the one time that it did happen was in early 2017, and Ooh. Lawyers descended to airports en masse.
Oh, yes. Oh, was, nice one. Good point.
Yeah, it was called, it was one article referred to it as the day the lawyer jokes died, because when Trump enacted that horrific travel ban with no thought, and I don't know what idiot with a crown wrote it, but they endangered lives and made people's life living hell.
Yeah.
Because all these sudden people were in limbo with, like, I can't leave the airport. I can't go anywhere. I'm now trapped here.
Yeah.
Because there's a racist bigot who thought this was a good idea. And lo and behold, lawyers stopped what they were doing, whether they were in sweatpants or cocktail dresses, and they descended to airports across the country. And the ACLU in the year before raised something like $3 million over the course of an entire year with online donations. And over that course of that weekend, they raised something like $36
million. Wow. Because,
yeah, apparently people are inherently good and we don't like seeing people get screwed. And lawyers were the good guys who rose to the occasion to make sure people weren't getting screwed. So yeah, there can be situations where I need a lawyer, and we do have wonderful footage now that our kind do step up.
Yay! That's a good point. That makes me feel better about our profession. That was a proud day for our profession. There are other days that are not so proud, but that one was good.
A lot of heroes out there.
That is true.
People, I mean, just, again, I wasn't one of them. I'm not an immigration attorney, but seeing people in sweatpants or whatever, sitting on the floor with a laptop trying to help somebody, it's just like, god damn, like, that's very inspiring. So
it is. I need to learn immigration law.
Yes, yeah, something to do in our free time, because everything else isn't complicated enough. So,
I know.
That said, the doctor didn't have a duty, but he stepped up anyway and helped save a bunch of people. Now, what about the flight attendant with the guitar that she borrowed from the nun?
Randy, right? I think was her name. And then she's singing to the girl from The Love Boat. Isn't that?
There's only one spirit.
Yes. That's just like gross negligence there, to be so oblivious next to her. I'm like, yeah, you could. Although also the mother is singing along and not even noticing, at least the first time around. But yeah, that's pretty funny. But definitely that is either gross negligence or willful or wanton misconduct there. Yeah.
She did have a lovely voice. So
she did. It was a very cute song. It made everyone else very happy. Oh, God.
Then there's the wife who starts losing it.
Yes. That one actually bothers me now, I have to say. That's, you know, there's some of this stuff. And again, I mean, I can show my kids, you know, I love Caddyshack. You can watch these old movies and I'm like, oh my God, kids, I'm embarrassed it was ever like that, but that's how it was. And I can kind of go with it. The whole, everybody lining up to beat up on the woman. I'm like, you know, that's not one that I can be okay with anymore, but that's clearly battery by a number of people there. And there is no excuse or justification for that.
I still crack up at the nun or Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the one part that I'm like, oh, that one. There are a couple, there's some other parts too where I'm like, oh God. I'm like, again, you know, you watch some of those or Cannonball Run, which I still love. I'm like, these are why we do need political correctness, because oh my God, like some of this stuff really is so awful. Yeah. And my kids watch some of this stuff and they just look at me like, what world did you grow up in? And I'm like, I'm sorry. We've learned a lot.
Now we're going to show you stuff from the 50s if you really want your mind blown. So
really does seem like the late 70s, early 80s, they really leaned into making it all really explicit and awful. You know, I mean, like Philadelphia Story is wonderful. And I don't think they had to lean into, I mean, oh my God, I can't even say some of the stuff that they say in some of those 70s and 80s movies. So I don't know, they really seem to lean into it then for some reason. I wonder why.
It was the extreme comedy. It was the thing you wouldn't expect and the thing that you would never want to happen in real life. But now we're trying to psychoanalyze humor.
Yeah, and I know. I'm sure it was all political too. There may have been political backlashes to things. I don't know. Film history is another area I'd love to get into someday. All my future careers.
we were like 5 or 6 when this came out, so like we really can't be held to that standard of being responsible for creating the content. But yeah, that was, you know, when we were both 9, this was freaking hysterical to watch. So
I know. Well, and I only saw the TV version for years then, of course, because, you know, this is back in the days where they would replay. I mean, so many of these movies you got to see on TV. I certainly wouldn't have seen it in the theaters, but you saw it on TV. So I don't know how old I was before I saw like the naked woman, like just the gratuitous boob shot there. You know, I'm like, wait a second, that wasn't in the version I saw for years, because I only saw it on TV replays for years and years.
That was, I saw it on VHS, and I still remember the glorious day when we got that JVC VCR with the different color buttons on it. And it's, I remember because we just came home from a trip with my dad and got dropped back off to my mom and stepfather, and going into the TV room and seeing the glorious VCR. And I recall that was one of the movies we rented.
Huh.
And I'm sure my mother, by today's standards, would be super liberal by what she allowed us to see without the hand over the eyes. So, yeah, but yeah, it's, yeah, I had forgotten about that until I watched it the other night. And it's like, oh, yeah, they did that.
Yeah.
Which was again, part of the joke of movies that did that, of just having the gratuitous naked lady run by.
There was a lot of that. My son loves Stripes for that exact reason. My son and my boyfriend. There was a lot of, that was a period of a lot of gratuitous boobs in the movies.
Yeah, it was a different era. Yes. I'm, how to talk to your kid about Stripes. That's, good luck with that.
It's fine. It's also a funny movie.
It is. It is. Again, another classic. So there's a lot in this film when you think about the legal issues, let alone being in the taxi cab and leaving the meter running.
Oh, that was hysterical that he goes back to turn it on and the guy just sits there, of course. Obviously, you would argue, yeah, there's no binding contract there. There's no way you have to pay that. Then I don't know if there's any legal issues, but still, actually, one of my favorite parts of the whole movie is the announcer couples who basically start airing their dirty laundry with each other. I mean, you could just do the airport alone. There's so much funny stuff. You don't even need to get on the plane to deal with the funny stuff. I love the airport, the announcers.
Oh, what's the what's the fastest land animal? Yeah, that's just so random. Such, again, 40 years.
And, you know, 40 years ago. Man, does that make me feel old.
Yeah, but there's a joy to some of these classic films that elements haven't aged well. Like something like that would not be made with that type of humor again. But some of it was just hysterical and brilliant, especially if you watched any of the airport movies.
Right. Yeah. Well, any of those disaster movies, I think they kind of based it on all those, which I, again, did not even have that. Again, I think because you talked before about like the Robert Stack and Leslie Nielsen, Lloyd Bridges. I mean, they consciously chose kind of B-level dramatic actors on purpose for those roles. So again, this is what we would have missed out on, the comedy then of seeing these otherwise very serious actors doing all this in a very deadpan way. Oh, because also Peter Graves, right? Again, yeah. Another very, you know, talking about Tell Me, Timmy. I mean, we didn't even get into the whole potential, like, you know, criminal laws and pedophilia issues going on there with the whole Tell Me, Timmy, have you ever been in a locker room when men are changing or whatever stuff? And you're like, oh my God, how are jokes about pedophilia okay in the 80s? Like, what is going on?
The interview with Peter Graves about that scene and how it was filmed, he was like so uncomfortable and worried about, am I going to get arrested afterwards? And the kid who played Timmy, they had interviews with him. Apparently still recognized, and he told the story of like rushing to get onto a flight, and as he got on the plane, the stewardess was there waiting for him and said, so have you seen a grown man naked? So it's like,
Oh my God.
Rock on. Yeah, so all of that gets into the weird contributing to the delinquency of a minor. There's a lot there.
I'm like, I don't even want to touch that stuff. I don't want to get my fingerprints on that train wreck.
Nope. I also do love Kareem Abdul-Jabbar threatening the kid. Listen, I've heard that crap since I was at UCLA.
I know. Oh God. I mean, there was so much brilliance in this, and the casting was brilliant. If we had been older and had the background with these actors and seen them being serious all the time and then being so absurd, but in such a deadpan way, that would have certainly added to it. And I do know is one of those that I think, what's surprising is a lot of movies like Airplane, you expect, and I think they even expected at the time that it wouldn't do well, right? That seems like the type of movie that would become a cult classic later, like the Rocky Horror Picture Show or something. But I think it was actually a huge hit at the time and probably ushered in a lot of those kind of absurd kind of comedies of the early 80s.
Through 90s, because Leslie Nielsen had a long career.
Oh, yes.
Whether it was, we have yet to touch Police Squad, which is one of my all-time favorite short-lived TV series of all time.
Right. And then the Naked Gun movies.
Yeah. And he did a bunch of other other ones. And then you also have the other parody films out there. Mm-hmm. But this is probably one, it might be the first great parody film that there were probably others, but they would be lesser known. But this one is great. And it has that title card. And it got a sequel that was, I tried replaying the same jokes over again with the space shuttle, but still, that was...
Captain Kirk was in it, and it was, I did like that.
Well, then I enjoyed Peter Graves with the, 2001 Hell 9000, type situation. So again, there were good elements with, I'm sorry, son, but Scraps has to be shot. There's things that... things that you hear when you're 12 that stay with you your entire life. And so again, common carriers have a high duty of care. We really don't see food service to that degree anymore. And
it's an extra big burden and of course cost for the airlines. Yeah.
And no kid's going to get to see the cockpit. So not in flight anyway, maybe on the ground, but that would be it. Mm-hmm. We don't do that anymore. It's an interesting time capsule. And we had to celebrate it because it's one of those Gen X watershed moments of comedic gold.
It seems fitting to end 2020 with a recap of a very funny disaster movie. maybe someday we'll be able to look back in 2020 and laugh at the disaster year that it is. Maybe 40 years from now, Josh, we can do a retrospective on 2020 and the 80th anniversary of Airplane and see what we think of it in another 40 years.
Yeah. I'd be 86. It's plausible.
It totally is. I'll be a couple years older than that, but I plan to still be around.
Yeah, I'm not planning to leave. Let's just put that on the table. But yeah,
we'll see if our country's still here. I'm still putting that at like 50-50, but I'll be around in some form. I may be speaking Russian.
I believe in us.
Yes, you're much more optimistic than I am.
Well, Agape won. So, on the ballot this time was bigotry and hatred and Agape, because Biden does represent... He's such a good dude. He's so nice. And he actually cares about people. He literally mentors kids with a stutter. Is nice. Likes ice cream. Cares. That was on the ballot versus narcissism and hatred. And the good guy won. I believe in us. We'll get through January 6th and people who are outright trying to commit sedition. One battle at a time, but I believe the good guy won, and we have a lot of work to do to help people because a lot of scary things have happened, but if anyone can land the plane, it's Papa Joe.
And nice way to end it. I like it.
Yeah. I believe in Papa Joe. So with that, everyone, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay geeky. Happy New Year.